I'm going to just tell my story, basically, or at least a version of it. And I kind of, when I was thinking about metaphors last night, this came to mind because I have a medical background. And the Environmental Working Group did a study in 2004. And what they did was they tested blood from the umbilical cords of 10 babies after they were born for chemicals. And what they found was that there's an average of 200 industrial chemicals and pollutants in these, just regular babies. And that includes pesticides, consumer product, ingredients, waste from burning coal, gasoline, and garbage. So among all the babies, there were 287 chemicals, and 180 of those are known to cause cancer. 208 of them are known to cause birth defects in either humans or animals. And then 217 are toxic to brain and nervous system development. And these are things that are absorbed just from walking around this world. You breathe them in through the air. You get them through the drinking water. You can pick them up through the skin. And we don't even notice them. You know, the babies got these from their moms. And I think that in a lot of ways, our core beliefs that we absorb from the environment, whether it's cultural or religious or theological, we absorb things that we don't even know we're absorbing. It just kind of filters into our system, almost in this like ambient sort of way. And I think that, one of my favorite examples is my friend Robin. Her 8-year-old son a little background. Robin homeschooled her 4 kids for a while, and they were in a community north of Atlanta. And the homeschooling co-op was, you know, where they did all their socializing, and, you know, they were very good about having a race-neutral environment for their kids, where they just didn't talk about it at all, good or bad. And one day, Robin was taking her son, Ryder, into the mall when a black gentleman that was ahead of them turned around, saw him coming, and let the door slam in his face. And his immediate reaction was, you know, mean black guy, he should just go back to Africa. And she was so shocked by that, she didn't know what, you know, why he said that and where that came from. So they talked about it, and it was fascinating to hear some of his assumptions come out. And what he had assumed was that all people of color were adopted into the United States by nice white people or white families. And the reason is because all of the parents and the grown-ups in their homeschooling co-op were white, and all the people of color were children who were transracially adopted from other countries. So based on that alone, he had formulated this entire worldview. And we just never know the beliefs that we internalize. So I just really appreciated that illustration. Now, when I was in junior high, I went to a school that I would say was probably pretty diverse on some level. But everyone kind of clumped in individual or ethnic groups. And it was the white kids who were popular, and the white kids got to, you know, be cheerleaders, and they were the honor students, and they were the ones who, you know, everyone talked about, and everybody else just sort of dreamed about being them, or like them, or I did anyway. And it didn't help because I remember a guy named Rob one day. There was some event at school, I don't remember what it was, but my mom came as a volunteer, and she said something to one of the teachers in her broken English, and you know, my parents came from Taiwan, and see, my dad came in 1969, my mom came in 1971, and you know, they were in their late 20s. He laughed. He was like, does she even speak English? You know, he said it like so mockingly, and I remember feeling both extreme anger and extreme shame, like, at the same time. It was just this horrible, like, I just wanted to crawl into a hole, either that or beat him up, but I couldn't beat him up, so. Yeah, and I just remember that just stuck to me in a really profound way. And then probably a few months after that, one of the really popular guys in eighth grade was mowing the lawn in his front yard, and two of my Asian friends walked by because they live in the neighborhood too. And he said to them, "I know y'all chinks like me, but you don't have to stalk me." And I wasn't there, but they told me that story on Monday, you know, because this happened on a weekend. And it felt like it happened to me too. Because what happens is you suddenly realize that you're put in a category. And when that happens, suddenly they're in a category. And one of two things happens. If you are at home getting affirmative messages about your ethnicity being something that's good and positive and, you know, beneficial, all those things, getting affirmation, then you kind of get angry when people attack you like that. And you're like, hey, you know, don't try to make me feel inferior. I'm not inferior. You're the one with the problem. But what happened with me is that our home life was so chaotic. My parents come from a very traumatized background. And they were really always in survival mode. There was a tremendous amount of anxiety and idiosyncrasies, really, you know, when we were in public. So that compounded this sense of shame that I had because I didn't have those positive messages at home. I just started feeling like, well, maybe Asian people really are all messed up. And maybe I should be white because they have it all together. And so when you're a kid, you don't realize that that's a silly notion. You just think that way, even if you don't have the words to put to those ideas. And so over, I guess, a number of years, this message over and over, white is right, white is better, white is best, white is normal, and I am other. And I think it followed me to college. Even though I went to a really diverse high school, I think by then some of those experiences had so scarred me that I even wanted to distance myself from my fellow Asian American students. You know, I'm not like you, which is a shame. So when I got to college, I attended a CRU meeting. Back then it was Campus Crusade for Christ. Mm-hmm. And I picked up a copy of the Four Spiritual Laws, and I read it, and I was like, that sounds pretty good. Kind of answered a lot of the questions I had had, and prayed the prayer at the end, and ta-da, I'm a Christian, you know. So it was kind of an interesting beginning, and I immediately got involved with the discovery groups and all of that. And when it came time to choose a church, I decided to not go to the Chinese church, not go to the Taiwanese church. And I chose to go to the Presbyterian church where my white friends were attending. And these decisions, I can't say I want to go to a white church. I never made that conscious decision, you know, quite that way. I just know that I did that. And so what happened was, you know, I sang the songs, I read the theologians that they promoted at the church, I embraced the predominant politics of the church where I was attending. But it wasn't all just theological. I also took in, you know, being Republican, being pro-missions but anti-illegal aliens, being, you know, against, you know, racism theoretically, but hating Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton anytime they spoke up against racial injustice because they're just inciting political division. And I listened to Rush Limbaugh and I watched Fox News. That was the world I was in. And I thought that that was right. And I thought that that was Christian. And, you know, I remember having this conversation with somebody and saying, Obama is a very, very evil man. You know, like full conviction, like that sort of like, I've decided, I know Jesus hates it. Like, you know, kind of, it was really, and it didn't even bother me. I just took it all in. So, oh, and it was also very pro-military, very patriotic, very pro-war on terror. Let's go bomb the heck out of all these people in the Middle East, you know. So a lot of that kind of ethos. I had a pastor that would preach from the pulpit about how finally someone with the courage of George W. Bush had the audacity to take down this horrible, evil dictator, Saddam Hussein. And this was preached from the pulpit Okay. And this is the same pastor that led Evangelism Explosion, about how to share the gospel and lead people to Jesus. You know, so all this is just like mishmashed in my brain. And I went on mission trips. I went overseas. You know, I took a medical team to Nigeria and I did all these things. Now, what happened was God in his sovereignty moved us out of Houston. I had been in that church for 14 years at this time. And we moved to first to San Antonio and we lived for a few years there. And then we moved to Atlanta. And something happened when we moved to Atlanta because the same denomination that we were a part of, PCA by this time, I was starting to feel a real disconnect from people. And it didn't feel like Houston. Houston was very international, very diverse, and very cosmopolitan, even though my church was preaching these sorts of things. And I just started feeling invisible at the church. I would be speaking to somebody after the church service in the hallway, and another person would come up and start talking to them. I would sometimes be mid-sentence, and this would happen. There would be no acknowledgement that I was even present. And at first, I just thought, well, maybe they didn't see me. You just start trying to rationalize yourself out of it. Because the last thing you want to do is conclude, oh, somebody's, you know, treating me with racial discrimination. But after this kept happening, I just sort of had to conclude that maybe that had something to do with it. And I would experience this at play groups. I would have conversations with people, ask them questions. Oh, what do you do? How long have you lived here? You know, what does your husband do? Oh, he's in seminary. He'll tell me about that. What's he studying? And then it would be like, okay, anyway. So anyway, tell me about what happened. And they would start talking to their friends, you know, about whatever they wanted to talk about. And I'd like, well, okay. I guess they're not curious about me. And I just found it really exhausting. I tried it for a year. You know, whether it was like going to Moms and Margaritas or, you know, women's Bible study in the morning and, you know, the women's play group for a while. I couldn't do it anymore. So I started to research multi-ethnic churches because I had never attended one. But I heard that they existed and I wanted to know if one existed in Atlanta. So we found one and we started going. And I remember they were doing a hymn that was one of the hymns that we sang at church. But in between the verses, like one person just started rapping. And I burst into tears. And I didn't even know why. I just was like, oh my goodness, it's a different expression of worship that I've never seen before, you know. And I think that was so powerful to me. I just really started to interrogate all my assumptions about what was Christianity, you know, and what is this, you know, theology, or is this theology with a cultural bent to it, or is this, you know, worship music, or is it, you know, Anglo-European worship music, you know, all those things that I had never thought about before. And I also started unpacking my own racial prejudice because I had never really been around communities of African Americans or really blacks in general, because there was, you know, I met people from, you know, Tanzania, and I met a woman who was from Great Britain, but whose, you know, mother was from Trinidad and her dad was from Jamaica. And so, you know, and we talked about why she doesn't identify with the African American title. And she's like, well, I'm just black. And you know what? Other people didn't like that. And my friend likes to be Afro-Latina. She doesn't like to be referred to as black. And, you know, so I started seeing the nuance and the complexity and the diversity within the black communities or communities, and also wrestling with my own prejudices and assumptions that had been built when I was in this whole other world. And I started realizing, man, I was really wrong about X and Y and Z. And how could I have thought this person was so evil? And now I'm hearing these people talk about how they have been a voice for them. And it was mind-boggling to me how different the interpretations were, you know. But I started being able to empathize with the different views. I also started to have to deal with class prejudice, you know, because I had never really been around working class, working poor, or even, you know, low middle class necessarily, and realize I had really been in an upper middle class, predominantly white, professional. That's a very specific demographic that I had assumed was simply Christian. So as I was, as I started building more and more relationships with people, I started understanding systemic injustice. I used to hear that term a lot. And there was a linguistics professor who wrote an article recently about how there's direct causation and then there's systemic causation. So direct causation is really easy for people to grasp. There's language. You can say X caused Y. But systemic causation, there's no language that says X caused Y. It has to be understood and captured. But you can only capture it if you are immersed in the community that's experiencing systemic oppression. And so I think that's why it's so difficult. We try to use words to capture what that is, when really you need to be in the world and seeing it and feeling it and touching it. And I think that's where the breakdown is, because you've got segregation going on too. So then these worlds don't intersect, you know. But there's power once you do start to intersect with these different communities, right? I start realizing that I've been living a lie or believing all these lies. I mean, I thought they were true. You know, I think even now I'm constantly reminded of my otherness as an Asian American. After the panel discussion yesterday, somebody came up to me and expressed, you know, what they related to and the things that I said. And we had this wonderful conversation. And then at the end of the conversation, he said, "Oh, by the way, what nationality are you?" You know, and it's such a tired question for us, because I'm like, I wanted to just be really snarky and say, "American, what nationality are you?" You know, but you can't really do that. Well, you can, but try not to. And I literally stared at him for about 10 seconds as I formulated my response, because I was like, I need to give the short version. I was like, I am a second generation Taiwanese American. I was like, gotta go, bye. You know. But that kind of thing wears on you. And I want to say a couple of months ago, 2 months ago, I took my daughter to the pool. And as we were getting out of the car, I hear this voice, "Konnichiwa! Konnichiwa!" And I just went, "Oh, no." And it was a kid's voice. And I looked up, and there's this whole group of kids from a camp. I think they were from the YMCA. And they were all African-American, and they had chaperones. And I was like, okay, what do I want to do? So I said, all right, he could be my friend's son, and if it were, she would want me to correct him, right? So I walked around, and I approached the chaperone. The group was all starting to leave. I said, "Are you the adult that's in charge of this group of kids?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "Can you introduce me to the child who was yelling at us?" Because what she had said was, "Hush, she can hear you." Mm-hmm. You know. So she walked me over to the group of kids. There were probably like 15 kids, and three adult chaperones. And they pushed this kid over. I remember his name was Tyrone. He looked terrified. He was probably only 9 years old, okay? But here's my reaction. I was like my heart was pounding and my stomach was churning, and I was like trying not to shake. And so they push him forward. It's like, "She wants to talk to you." You know? And then they look up and see me, and some of them are like, "Oh." You know? And I said, "Were you yelling konnichiwa at me?" And he said, "Yes, I'm sorry." And I said, "Okay, do you know what that is?" I said, "That's hello in Japanese." I said, "I'm not Japanese." I said, "I'm actually American I'm Taiwanese American." I should have gone into, and, you know, "Japanese colonized us for 50 years."
right. Let me teach you something about history. And I said, you need to learn to treat people with respect and not just a certain way because of how they look. He said, I know, I'm sorry. I said, and I know you understand this because I know that sometimes you probably are treated like that too. Mm-hmm. And I put my hand on his shoulder and I said, it's okay. Mm-hmm. And then I turned around and walked away as fast as I could because I was about to burst into tears. I really was. It was traumatic. But at the same time, I thought about what enabled me to respond that way to Tyrone, and it was love. And I couldn't have responded that way even 3 years ago. I would have been like, stupid kid, you know, or stupid racist kid, or, you know, or whatever it was. And actually, to be honest, it would have been, you know, probably similar to mean black kid, why should he, you know, because I hadn't grappled with all those prejudices yet, mm-hmm. right? And because I had, I didn't see him as, you know, bleep, bleep, you know, whatever, whatever kid. I saw him as a human being who's somebody's son. And I wanted him to see me as a person. And so it's that connection, I think, that's important. And that was healing for me to be able to do that. And so these sorts of conversations, it's not just all like black, white. It's like, how do we all get in the mix with each other, right? You know, in the system that's often binary. And I think that kind of breaking out of this very specific demographic also gave me permission to explore the roots of my own trauma. Because, you know, I've been part of a community that was very, like, you know, emotionally shut down and not very receptive to working through, you know, massive, like, psychological trauma and things like that. So this past year I went to a therapist to really work through some issues related to childhood trauma. And he asked me if I knew anything about my parents' history. And I said, well, a little bit. I mean, I know my mom came from a large family of eight, and my dad from a very poor family of four. And I don't know, they worked a lot of hours, and my dad had to beg for food at one point in his life. You know, those are the things that I knew. And he encouraged me to think about Philippians 1:9, which is a prayer that Paul says, I pray that you would abound more and more in love through knowledge and depth of insight. And my counselor had said, because sometimes getting the right knowledge and the right insight helps your love to abound more and more in places where it falters, right? So I started praying this. And as I'm praying, I realize I don't know a thing about Taiwanese history. Like, how can I only be one generation removed and know nothing? And it's because my parents had been so traumatized that they didn't want to talk about it. They're like, this is a new start. We're in America. Just work hard, be successful, you know, and don't worry about anything else. So I started reading the history, and I was just really shocked by what I found. It was like, well, it goes way back. I mean, colonization, the Dutch even colonized Taiwan back in the 17th century. But, you know, Japan did, starting in 1895. And I read that from 1895 until 1945, there were 19 separate uprisings, like major uprisings, that resulted in tens of thousands of deaths and just as many imprisonments. And that was my grandparents' generation. And I remember meeting my grandmother when I was like 8 or 9, our first and only trip to Taiwan. And I couldn't communicate with her. Because my parents had decided not to teach my brother and me Taiwanese. They decided to teach us Mandarin, because that was the language of mainland China. And there were more of them, and they didn't think that it would benefit us to learn Taiwanese. But my grandparents only spoke Japanese and Taiwanese. So here we were, you know, one generation removed. I couldn't communicate with them. I couldn't even tell my grandmother I wanted apple juice, you know. Not that they had it. They didn't have apple juice in Taiwan back then. And I didn't really understand the significance of that until now, really think about it. And another thing was, my mom said, "Do you really want to know history?" I was like, "Yeah, I do. I think it's important. We got to know where we came from and why things worked out a certain way." She was like, "Okay, well, you know I'm lucky to be alive." I was like, "What do you mean?" She was like, "Well, I almost got bombed." I was like, "What?" Wow. So she told me the story about in 1944. Now, you know, you're starting to put together Japan was a big enemy in World War II, and Taiwan's a Japanese colony. So, of course, in 1944, the U.S. launched massive air raids against Taiwan. It was really against the Japanese in Taiwan. And my mom said that, yeah, like all the families had dug, you know, underground shelters, these makeshift shelters to hide in when the bombing raids would start. And she was only about a year, at this time. And when the raid started, everybody rushed to get to the shelter, but she was left behind because she wasn't walking yet. And then her oldest sister realized that she wasn't there. She ran back out and got her. And as they ran back in, that's when a bomb, like, detonated and, like, destroyed the house. And she told me that, you know, after Japan surrendered and they were trying to rebuild their lives, she said, of course, like, we lost everything in all the bombing raids. Everything had been burned up. We didn't even have dishes to eat on. And she said, yeah, my family decided, well, we're going to, like, contribute that. We're going to make, you know, ceramic, you know, plates and bowls and sell those and try to make a living. And then other people who had rice fields would, you know, sell, you know, food on the streets. And everybody was just trying to eke out an existence. My older cousins would go to the local lake and dig for clams, and that would be their food for the day. You know, and she said, I mean, the only way out of that survival mode was to, like, get an education. And only a few people could get into the schools. You had to have money to go. They didn't have free education. And only the best students could get into the schools, which there were only limited spots. And then she told me, she said, oh, yeah, and we also had all these, like, air raid drills at school all the time. And my dad was always so anxious anytime my brother ran out and had to run an errand. He was always scared that he would never come back. And this was the environment that they grew up in, you know. I was wondering, why are you so freaking out over the rice burning? You know, everything's an emergency for you, you know. And it's not so judgy now, you know, now that I know what they had lived through. So where was I going with that?
Therapist.
Yeah. Okay, so I find all this out, and also that they lived through this major event called 228 is because there was a massive insurrection in March of 1947, a week after the governor declared martial law. And I think some of the governor, well, Chiang Kai-shek's government had been really oppressive. There was a lot of public resentment. He would just confiscate people's wealth and, you know, just really unjust things happening. And I think one of the government workers hurt somebody on the street, and then, you know, there was a riot. And then there were other riots that ensued after that, and so that's why he declared martial law. And then, of course, the military patrol started driving through and started indiscriminately shooting people in Taipei. And that led to a massive insurrection, which then caused the governor to, you know, request for additional military support from China. And they arrived, 13,000 troops arrived a week later, and they just started raping, shooting, bayoneting everybody. They even killed children. They took all the people who could have been, everybody who was a leader in Taiwanese society at the time, teachers, leaders of, you know, civic associations, newspaper editors, lawyers, and they publicly tortured them, mutilated them, and executed them. And by the end of this event, like, at least 28,000 people had died. And that's just what is recorded by the government. So you know there were tons more deaths than that. And then tons more imprisonments after that, which is why my grandfather was a rack whenever my uncle had to go out, because there was so much political unrest. And, you know, you think about the patriotism and the pro-military stance and all that military might and nationalism that has gotten married to Christianity in some of these circles. And here I embraced that at one point in my life, completely without any knowledge of why my family was so messed up. Like zero, I just thought, ugh, of course it's better to be white, you know. And now I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, part of that, I might not even be here because of the military actions of my own country. But it is my country. I've never known any other country. And so this is really strange ambivalence that I feel. I love my country, but I also recognize where it's evil, you know, and where, you know, you can call something a just war, but what do you do about the collateral damage, about people like us who are damaged not just immediately, but for generations? You know, because the trauma is passed down. They've done all these studies on Holocaust survivors and how it even changes your DNA, you know. And I remember when my daughter was born, the slightest sounds would cause her to, you know. And she was like that for like 6 months, you know, as if some major sound went off. And I just think even she carries the marks of the trauma that my grandparents and my parents endured and that I endured as a result of their trauma, you know. And I think about the people who survived slavery and Jim Crow and lynching and mob terror and all those things, and then we're not even that, it's still living memory, and our country already wants to forget. They're like, why are you bringing up the past? Well, because it totally is relevant to the present, right? There's a lot of similarities too, like when I was reading about Japanese colonization, because what they did was they practiced a really strict form of ethnic apartheid, and they tried to erase the Taiwanese language and Taiwanese culture, and they tried to turn Taiwanese people on the island into second-class Japanese citizens. So I want you to forget who you are and become Japanese, but not, you can't actually become Japanese because you're always inferior to us. Full citizenship belongs to us, you know. And I just think about how empires that have a desire to exert power over everybody, they operate in the same way. It's the same methodology. You know, and it's oppressive, and it maims, and it kills, and it destroys. And it's sad when it gets married to Christianity, which is the polar opposite of all that, you know. And it feels really good to be free from that and to actually be engaged in, you know, I don't know, Jesus' work. You know, where I walk into the pain and the experiences of people in their daily life. And I'm still learning, I'm still growing, and I'm still trying to figure this all out, you know. But I praise God for all that He's done. I wanted to just kind of open up to questions, comments, discussion. There's a lot of different... Yes?
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's okay.
First, I want to say thank you for being open and doing this. But I also had a question that I don't mean for this to be taken literally. I just don't know. Why was it so hard, or is it so hard for anyone to hear the question, what nationality was?
The reason that is because I could be a fourth generation American, and nationality is a question of citizenship. So what nationality are you? Romanian, you know, Czechoslovakian, Spanish, Italian, you know, whenever it's asked of me, it's because they think, oh, what country are you from? Or what, you know, and sometimes what they mean is, oh, okay. The question was, you know, why is it so hard for me to hear the question, what nationality are you? Yeah. And I think it's the presumption of foreignness, you know, it comes up a lot.
How could someone better ask that question if they want to know more about your culture?
Yeah, how can someone better ask that question? That's a very good question. So it would be, what is your ethnic background? I think is a much more precise and accurate way to ask, more sensitive. Because, of course, you know, I don't look white. What people say, what category of Asian are you? You know? Because that's actually what they're wanting to know, right? That's what's hard about it. When's the last time someone came up to you and asked you what your nationality was?
They don't. I mean, unless it's someone who's actually from Africa, then they ask me, I'm from Africa. Like, I don't know what tribe I would be from. So.
Right. Yeah. Or.
I'll never be asked that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I mean,
I just got asked that today.
Yeah.
You just, you
where
did.
Are you from? It was the from.
Oh.
The
yes.
The emphasis on the final.
You don't fit in here.
Yeah. I'm like, I was born in Puerto Rico, which my nationality would still be U.S.
U.S.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think people understand. I don't think they know that nationality is actually a tied citizenship.
Yeah.
They mean to say, what's your ethnic background?
Right.
They end up saying, what's your nationality? So
yeah.
The definition of terms.
Yeah,
for most people.
Yeah. So that's the technical aspect of it. But I think the visceral part of it, which makes it hard, is because the real question is, what category of Asian are you? You know, and I was like, why don't people just ask it that way? That's what they mean anyway, you know. And I got to tell you the story. When I was working as a physician assistant at MD Anderson, I was doing a history and physical on a patient from East Texas, and she had two of her friends there, and they were probably all in their late 60s. And in the middle of, have you been coughing up blood? Have you been having night sweats? Are you losing any weight? You know, you from China? And I said, oh no. Oh, and you know, I don't want to like make fun of the accent or anything because, you know, but that, I mean, I'm pretty good at accents. I can do all kinds of accents. I'm not saying that, you know, they were stupid or anything, but that's how, that's what I heard, right? Okay, so I'm hearing this, that they're from East Texas. It's a regional accent. I was like, no, I'm from Houston. I was born and raised here. And then I'm continuing the interview, and her other friend interrupts and says, are you from Korea? And then the other lady said, no, she just said she's from Houston. Didn't you hear her? And he said, well, she looks like she's from somewhere. You know, I'm still in the room. And I am still trying to get a history from your friend who has lung cancer. You know, and these are the sorts of experiences that, you know, I encounter frequently. And also, you know, my family and I went to a barbecue restaurant in Atlanta, and we walk in, and there was like nobody in the restaurant. It wasn't loud. And I walk up to the counter, and the young man behind the counter, he's probably, couldn't have been more than 20 years old. I said, are your collard greens spicy? Because I was trying to decide whether to get them for my daughter, because she likes collard greens, but she hates spicy food. Okay. And he said, I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? I was like, I do not speak with an accent, you know, but the expectation actually kept him from hearing what I actually said. It's really amazing, though, the filter that goes up, you know. And so, like, Peter looked at my husband, and he looked at me, he's like, wow, you know, that really just happened. So it's hard to explain always feeling objectified and perceived a certain way. Yes.
Question. So how do you try and teach some of these things to your children?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because my daughter is biracial. My husband is white. And she's actually processing a lot of angst over her ethnic identity right now. Okay. We had her in a private Christian school last year for kindergarten for most of the year. And it's predominantly white. And she was the one of the only, okay, there was another child in the class that was half Cuban, half Mexican, but he was fair, he had a fair complexion. And so to, you know, he could pass as white. Yeah. And she probably could too, you know, my daughter, but she spends a lot of time with me. So I think she's internalized a lot of like a sense of Asian identity. And she told me, "Mommy, I wish I was all white and not half white and half Asian." And she's like, "Because, you know, Asians just look kind of funny." I said, "Oh, well, tell me about that. You know, what do you mean?" And she was like, "Yeah, like, we have funny eyes." I said, "Well, let's talk about that. Do we really?" I said, "Do we really?" It's like, "Are you telling me I have funny eyes?" She goes, "Well, no." You know? But what's interesting is, again, that whole idea of ambiance, right? It's just filtering in from the environment. And the other thing I noticed at the school was all the people who worked maintenance and did the custodial stuff and directed traffic and did housekeeping were all people of color. Mm-hmm. But all the administrators and all the teachers, except for like one or two, were white. Mm-hmm. And so already that system is communicating, these people do this, these people do that. You know, and I was having a conversation with, you know, the teacher about it, as well as the school counselor, and they said, "Well, how can we make her feel better? I know, we're going to have more lessons on celebrating diversity." I'm like, not when she's the only, like, non-white kid. That's just going to make her feel worse, you know? And then I said, "Well, we'll have you come in and talk to the class about Taiwanese culture." I said, "Well, how is that going to help? Actually, I don't know anything about Taiwanese culture." I can tell you what it's like to be Asian American, you know, with Taiwanese parents. And what that's like. So there's a lot of misunderstanding, and it's because when you don't have to understand anybody else's culture, sometimes you just fail to, you know. We have to understand white culture. We live in it. We swim in it, you know. We would drown if we didn't know how to navigate in that world. So, yeah, we talk pretty openly, and I think that because we had a black family living with us for a while, and she said she's my sister, and, you know, I love her color skin. I wish my skin was brown too. And, you know, we just kind of just affirmed all those observations, and there's no weirdness when we talk about it, you know, until like Charleston happened. And the Charleston shooting, she and I talked about it, and I showed her the pictures of all the victims, and I read her, you know, who they were, what they did. And she goes, "Why would anyone kill people just because of the color of their skin?" I said, "That's a very good question. We are still trying to figure that out." But after that, she said, "Mommy, I'm glad I'm not black." And I love the honesty of children, because I know why she said that. And I think what she's actually articulating is that she recognizes the privilege of not being black.
Right.
And I'm not going to say, "Well, don't say that. That's a terrible thing to say," you know, because actually she's being more truthful than like most of the adults are capable of being, right?
Yeah.
You know, and then she said something about she's glad she has fair skin or whatever. I said, "Well, remember you used to say you wanted brown skin like so-and-so?" She goes, "Yeah, but that was before I knew they were endangered."
Oh,
I know. So I said, "Well, you know what is a better response than saying, 'I'm glad I'm not black and I'm glad I'm not endangered,' is to help make this world better so that that is not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Do what we can so that that is not the reality."
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's like, "You know what? If anyone came and tried to shoot my friends just because they're black, I would punch them in the butt." Training up a little future social justice warrior. So, yeah, I think one of the things I'm committed to is letting her be in her process. Letting her say those things. "I wish I was white instead of half white, half Asian. I feel like I don't fit in. I don't even fit in my family. I'm the only half, and, you know, you're totally Asian. Daddy's totally white, but I'm this in between." You know, and she has to figure out what that means for her. I just keep saying the affirming things while trying not to deny those feelings of conflictedness that she feels, you know, because I know that it's a dynamic process. And then, you know, as we were looking into camps and things, I said, I'm going to try to put you in a camp where there's, you know, different kinds of kids. She goes, can you find one where there's all half white, half Asian kids? I said, honey, we don't live in California. We live in Atlanta, Georgia. We have to go to like Norcross or like, you know. And she's like, why do we have to live in Atlanta? Yeah, so it's I'm not an expert having these conversations, but I just try to listen and validate. You know.